Now, many of you know that we have that prayer list on Friday, that consciousness where you just give positive energy and thoughts to people who need help in any form or fashion. So throw some your way, because we're going to put on the list the grandchild of a couple great people who are part of the NighthawkZone.com. They've got a little grandchild who's in the hospital, Moondog Mooncat, part of the NighthawkZone.com, and they just need your prayers for her. So do that. Think about her Friday when you do your mass consciousness and your prayer. When we come back, more with John Klimo as we talk about the handbook to the afterlife on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, we're with John Klimo. John, in your opinion, is there a particular process that the newly dead go through? Can you kind of give us what this training manual is all about?
Well, the training manual, as you call it, has the steps that come from the consensus of all these different sources that have a lot of similarity across them. And, there's a separation from the body where you're no longer embodied and you're leaving your body. So you have an out-of-body experience, and you may look back on your body, look back on the room, but you're beginning to lose your tether, your connectedness, your umbilicus, your silver cord to this level of reality into your own body. That seems to be common with the out-of-body experience that tends to go with it. You're not going to be able to get back in your body. That's the only difference. And then there's entering the afterlife, getting a sense of that you're not in Kansas anymore, something's going on. That depends on the level of lucidity or lack of lucidity you have, as I said before.
Right.
Recognizing you're dead, that you're no longer physically alive, can help matters. It can move you on quicker. You can reach out for spirit help. It depends on the homework you've done and how informed you are about what's likely to happen. For people who are pretty woefully ignorant of that, like my father was, they're just lost. They get over there, they're absolutely lost, and kind of terrified. They didn't expect anything. And so when they have something, how do you explain that to yourself when you didn't expect anything? Because you're creating your own reality. If you didn't expect any reality on the other side, is there going to be a void, or are you going to try to grapple with rationalization of what you're faced with, which does seem like, as I say, this kind of post-Cartesian or non-dualist dream where it's a more unified field that includes inner and outer all mixed together, and you're experiencing it as your experience in your surrounding environment. That's a big jump from all our life on Earth here, where you have the sense that you're squatting inside of your physical body, looking out through the eye holes, and your consciousness and your subjectivity somehow is this little soft, pudgy thing inside of you, and you're moving around in a physical world and a physical body. That doesn't happen when you get to the other side, unless you're very non-lucid, and then in this sort of non-lucid dream, you'll be experiencing the dream material, the astral plane, and how it can be influenced by your intentionality and your expectations and so on. There'll be some degree of plasticity of how you're going to create your own reality there, but it'll be fairly limited. The more lucid you are, the more unlimited it'll be. So you realize you're dead, or you don't, and you're still having to grapple with that. You separate from the body. You begin to meet some spirit helpers, if you're lucky. Sometimes you're left to hang by your own petard there, so to speak, because you are in more of a purgatorial or a hellish place, because you made a place for yourself that way out of ignorance or out of lack of doing your homework or out of your own fears and self-centeredness and whatever else.
Sure. So they may not come and save you or pull you out of it.
Not initially. But okay. But I from all my research, sooner or later you are helped. Sooner or later, it's a benevolent universe. It's a spiritual, generous universe, and there are only short sojourns and doer stucknesses within purgatories and hells and punishment domains, I believe. But that most of the world's religions, say you're either going to go to heaven or hell, and you're not going to get out of the hell, and that's just too extreme. But I'm tilting against hundreds of millions of people and centuries of stuff there, so I can't expect people to come get detached from that thing they were raised with. So you separate from your body, you meet spirit helpers. If you're lucky, it may take longer than other times. You move to various levels of existence, and levels of density or frequency or subtlety of energy or dimensionality. But then again, you don't notice it's happening much. It's very muffled and lost and bewildered if you're fairly non-lucid.
Is it like being in a fog?
Yeah, it's like being in a fog. For example, Lawrence of Arabia, the historical figure, after he died, he was kind of a rascal and kind of a wasn't a perfect paragon of a human being while alive, although he was heroic in certain ways. Well, he dictated a whole book from the other side after he got over there, and there was a long period of time when he was in a real purgatory, a real kind of hellish, murky, gray, soupy, crappy. It's like, oh God! And then he was had enough lucidity to be really tasting it and experiencing it, and he really rubs off on you to read this whole book. It's one of many books by people who described not a paradise-like place, not a heaven-like place, but something other than that for a while. But then sooner or later, they move out of that realm, too. Time is very different over there as well, too. There's recovering time where you go through a period of sleep or isolation or healing places like hospices. You know, if you don't think there's going to be anything on the other side or it's not like what your religion taught you, at least eventually, then you have to kind of recuperate. You have to transition, and they don't want to wake you up abruptly. You know, they work, give you warm milk and cookies, you know, and with beautiful kind of heavenly things outside of your window of your suite there. So, whether I'm talking literally or figuratively, it doesn't much matter. Sometimes it's quite literally for their experience of it. So there's healing places, and there's restoration of energy. I mean, like, and there's different communities. The different realms in the afterlife are very often, you know, kind attracts kind. And this kind of genetic code, as I said, this interior expectations and memories and beliefs and conditionings that we carry over as sort of inner us, when we get over there, it becomes the seeds and the reality creation programs that attract to us within the afterlife scenarios and experiences and things to go through and learn from, just like we did on this level of reality, but it's much more direct there. And all the people hang out together who had the same belief system or same expectation system. So these enclaves in the afterlife of Christian ones and Islamic ones and Buddhist ones and whatever. And so kind attracts kind within the karma of the kind of inner set you brought with you into the afterlife. Then there's a reviewing and a judgment of the lifetime, the life review, which many of your readers have heard about. I say readers, we're all reading each other over the radio, listening.
Well, they're extensive readers too. So
yeah, but the life review, and you know, it's not the Old Testament. From all my research, says to me that it is not an Old Testament God with a big beard, rather punitive. The St. Peter's Gate, the judgment kind of a thing. We're going to look down and we're going to ding you on these things. Then we decide whether you get to move on. You know,
mean there aren't little angels on clouds with little, you know, little harps?
Well, you know, look, if when you die, you had a lot of those programs in you, a lot of those stories, a lot of those expectations. You get into the afterlife, you'll be experiencing angels on clouds and harps and stuff. Not forever, but for a while, because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It is creating your own reality. Oh yes, yeah, and that's why. There's something called Summerland in the literature about the afterlife. Summerland is a term used a lot for a paradise-like place, a really just dream come true. The just desserts you get of having lived a good life, especially a good Christian life, you go to Summerland. And Summerland is like Hollywood with all the budget in the world, plays out what you and all those who deserve this can all live together and, you know, and just look like Ozzy and Harry. This is perfect. And I'm not degrading it. I'm just saying that you created that for yourself. All of you did, because you had that set of expectations, like a genetic program that grew the fruit of those experiences for a while, at least, until you get it out of your system or learn as the lucidity increases, the awakeness and the metacognition, the awareness that you can look back on and reflect more on what's happening. Lucidity and metacognition, being able to think about your thinking and what's going on, or go hand in hand. So the life review is something you do for yourself. You actually look at your own life and you judge it. You are the judge. You are the jury. Now, there could be other beings in the spiritual realm that could, you know, kibitz over your shoulder about it a bit, or help you interpret it more, or have you review parts of it you might have looked at too quickly. But the life review is quite comprehensive. It's kind of holographic. It's extraordinarily detailed. It's breathtaking for some people, because it's like you see everything that was meaningful in your whole life flashes before you, but time is different and so on.
Right.
So,
and good and bad, right?
Oh, sure, of course, yeah. Yeah. It's the old tally. So the traditional religions have their story about that, but the story from the consensus about all the afterlife mediumship and channeling and near-death experiences and so on loads on the side of another version of an afterlife, of a life review that has certain similarities, but you're the judge, and you decide that you need another lifetime on Earth, or you need to have the shoe on the other foot. If you were the master, it's your turn to be the slave. If you were black, it's time to be white. If you were rich, it's time to be poor. Just to learn the whole, so that you, when you get the, when you become an angel, or you become a truly ascended spirit in the soul growth evolution through soul, you're an immortal spirit, according to the perennial philosophy, as I see it. And it takes a long time to really learn all you have to learn from being a sentient being across many lifetimes and embodiments and kinds of persona and experience. And in that time, you try on all shapes and sizes and modes of experience. You're not. It's a very generous universe. It's a very generous, ample universe that gives you an opportunity to go backstage and try on all the different costumes, all the different characters, and then you reach a point of wisdom that doesn't come from one lifetime usually, according to this literature. And you get to meet others. You go through spiritual growth. There's schools over there you can learn from. There's the spirit guides on that side for you. Then they can look at reincarnating, whether that's going to reincarnate, and there's quite a bit of.
How long do you think that reincarnation process is? Even though time doesn't mean anything over there.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, you'd be surprised how much of the mediumistic channel literature, where deceased human spirits are communicating back and telling their stories and their descriptions of the afterlife and what the process was like, or just spirits in the spirit realm who are describing it similarly. And they very often do not talk about reincarnation. They talk only about moving onward toward the light and in ever further refinement and evolution of the soul growth, ever closer to God or Source or universal consciousness field core of where everything is all kind of an identity condition and just a love bed of being. They don't necessarily talk about this traditional reincarnational picture. So you have to ask yourself, if you're a student of this tremendous literature like I am, well, is there reincarnation or not? Well, there certainly is enough evidence and stories about reincarnation, including the parapsychological research about reincarnation and past lives and so on, to convince me that there is reincarnation. But whether or not every human spirit who leaves physical incarnation goes into the afterlife as a discarnate spirit, not all of them may need to come back or want to come back or choose to come back. Maybe that's the generosity of life. You make that decision after the life review and what you've learned so far and what still needs to be experienced and internalized and grown from to become a truly loving spirit, like an angel perhaps, who knows, that you decide you need to reincarnate. Maybe when we hear stories from people that they don't know what you're talking about when you ask them through mediums or whatever, is there reincarnation? They say, I don't know, not that I know of. And you say, well, that doesn't mean there isn't any? No, not necessarily. It just means the person, the witness you're talking to, hasn't run across it in their own path. But I do believe there's reincarnation. Then there are adjustment problems. There can be grief. There can be ignorance about the afterlife. There can be regret. Inability to love, there could be psychological baggage that you take over with you. You know, all these kinds of things that I had somewhat alluded to earlier are creating your own heaven or hell, are creating the expectations and the experiences you're going to have and the things you need to go through there. And they are now just like the ultimate audiovisual aid or the ultimate industrial light and magic. It's filling your environment. It's filling your lived experience. It's you're moving and having your being embedded within these kinds of things that have their causal grounds or their correlations in what you took over into death with you that you had cultivating while you were still alive, but maybe not very, very lucidly.
Who put this all together? I've had my doubts, like you have. Mm-hmm. I believe it, like you do. Mm-hmm. But who put this incredible puzzle together?
Well, some of your listeners may know the Urantia book.
Yes, book of Urantia, I guess.
Urantia book. That's a piece of work, I'll tell you. I recommend it to people as a real perplexing, fascinating thing. Big, fat book. It purports to describe this sort of house of many mansions, just multidimensional, extraordinary domain that's basically non-physical, although there are pockets of it that are physical, or like planet Earth and others. There's all manner of lineage and beings and human and otherwise. And it is fascinating. It was a channel book. I mention it because there are, in the hierarchy of from the Urantia book, the hierarchy of how the universe is built, what's the island paradise or paradiso right in the middle of it all, I think, where God lives, I guess, that there are all kinds of, like, the fruit of the loom, the lords of karma, God knows, all these kinds of variations on the theme of spiritual hierarchy, ascended masters, never incarnated beings, angels, et cetera, et cetera. And it, according to the channel literature and according to the survival literature to a certain extent, some of these sources are pointed to as being in charge of certain aspects of this. It's like a great huge corporation, transpersonal, transphysical corporation of beings, of entities that comprise the multidimensional universe that is probably infinite and eternal and outside of our local space and time. And so who do you attribute it to? Well, ultimately God, ultimately a supreme being. Some people don't like to hear those terms. You could just say the universe itself with a capital U. I like to think of a universal consciousness field. That's the way my research goes. Everything is this consciousness. Everything is a spiritual consciousness field. It's universal, it's infinite, it's eternal, and out of it can manifest all the objects and contents of consciousness, and all those having consciousness, those local individualized beings like us, or extraterrestrials, or deceased human spirits, and we all cohabit this consciousness field within which we are allowed by the function of what our consciousness does, can pull out of that consciousness field all kinds of experiences, all kinds of objective realities, all kinds of consensus realities, shared realities, all kinds of technologies to move through this consciousness field. We can be non-lucid enough or whatever to be able to experience the consciousness field and our own existence within it, not in terms of consciousness or this vast consciousness field, but in terms of nuts and bolts and physics and physical reductionism and atheism and everything else. There's room for everybody to be creating their own reality. So in that sense, who created it all? I believe that the universe is a being, is a continuous being. It's not just a holograph. It's not just a hologram. It's a universal mind. It's infinite. It's an infinite creator. I pray to an infinite creator.
Maybe it's not real at all, John. Maybe the whole thing is an illusion.
Oh yeah. That's the Maya that we sit here proudly from our New Age framework and say all these people are stuck in their Maya. Well, we New Agers could be stuck in our own Maya. With the will to believe that these pipe dreams and these security blankets and these explanation systems and these stories around the campfire has more reality than the hot stove that can give you a blister.
That could very well be, indeed. Tell us about your website, John.
Yeah, it's just my name, www.johnklimo, with no H, JohnKlimo.com. I put on it about a book and a half's worth of verbatim, a full text of articles and papers and presentations that most of them center around my understanding of the universe and how it really operates based upon thousands of books and great deal of research, not only the extraterrestrial area, but also the survival of death area, the parapsychological area, the spiritual transpersonal area, all intermixed, and I get this sort of picture of pictures out of it all, and that has to do with this universal consciousness field and we being kind of offspring of the universal creator and made in the image of it and doing our own creating as we go and eventually evolving toward being at one with or an identity condition with that universal creator field, creation, creator field. That's the way I make most sense of it. And so a lot of these articles and pieces, if your listeners are interested, are like that. Then there's videos and there's audio tapes and there's a lot of things like that. And there's my whole 22-page CV. There's more than you want to know about me, believe me.
And we've got the link up for you at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, we'll get into this ET channeling. And the next hour, we'll take phone calls with John Klimo right here on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Joe Klimo. A few more questions to go, though, when I come right back on Coast to Coast AM. What got you to write the book about the relationship between channeling and ETs and UFOs, Joe? John. Hello, John.
Hello.
Yeah, there you are. You with me?
Yeah, I'm with you right here.
Okay. All right. What got you to write the book between the relationship between channeling and ETs and UFOs?
Well, I've studied extraterrestrials and extraterrestriology, ufology. I love those two together. As long as I've studied anything else, I did my senior thesis writing project in high school in 1959 on Project Blue Book, the Air Force research. So I've been attracted in love with that field, in awe of that field ever since, and it's just consumed everything there is on it, like many of your listeners have as well. But over time, I began to realize that as a parapsychologist also, which I am, there's only a few hundred of us in the world, actually, but we're an endangered species because mainstream science and academia, you know, doesn't look favorably upon these things, as I said earlier, and so it keeps it locked out in large part.
It doesn't mix, does it?
Right. Kind of predictably so, from the lens, you know, that analogy I used before. If you look through the lens they're looking through, they see such things as pseudoscience and quackery and superstition and things like that. The lens I look at it, I look at their science as quite limited and only a piece of the larger picture. But anyway, the as the years went by and I just lived with this material, I began to see that a lot of the things that parapsychology studies, like telepathy or extrasensory perception, or I like the term anomalous cognition, mm-hmm. a kind of knowing and information processing that we don't understand how it works according to Western science, things like that, and then we could include mediumship and telepathy and channeling. Then also things like psychokinesis or unusual mind-matter relations and how mind can affect matter or intentionality can affect material systems, living or non-living, living, and levitation and transubstantiation and materialization, dematerialization. All of these things, you know, there's a whole constellation of these things that fall under parapsychology, including survival research, study of survival of physical death. But what I began to realize is I would read these numerous depictions and descriptions from contactees and abductees, and then as time went on, with channeled communications from purported extraterrestrials about themselves and where they come from and their technology and how they operate and how they see the larger universe, et cetera. As I looked at all this, I began to see a pattern that a certain amount of the larger extraterrestrial UFO understandings were coming to us by way of some kind of channeling or anomalous cognition. It wasn't, you know, nuts and bolts, person gets out of the ship, walks over to you, you know, give you a set of pancakes or whatever they're going to do, and says something cryptic and then gets back on the ship or takes you on the ship and gives you an exam. I mean, that kind of physical level one is part of the picture, and so is abduction part of the picture. And in the earlier conscious contactees, kind of lucid contactees, who claimed to have interactions with extraterrestrials and taken on trips and so on, seen their home planet, but would stayed conscious and it wasn't, they weren't abducted and they did it willingly and so on. And well, in all those cases, a piece of the puzzle was not just contactee information about ETs. It was also, it wasn't just abductee part of it too, the more recent, but also this third domain, channeling. Or anomalous cognition, or I'm including it to telepathy here too, and that became a bigger and bigger piece of the puzzle, that more and more of the detailed information about UFOs and extraterrestrials and the whole horse they rode in on, the whole mm-hmm. shebang, was the fine detail, the even the technical detail, was being supplied by channeled material more than the more limited stuff you would get from a contactee or an abductee. You'd have to kind of read between the lines and interpret a lot of the stuff that would come back from hypnotic induction, age regression, relivings of these things. You get glimpses of that, but you get much more direct if you're talking to somebody who claims to be an extraterrestrial telling you about, here's what it's like on my own planet, here's how I get here, here's how we exceed the speed of light, here's where we are in our civilization now compared to yours, here's why we're hanging around you now like anthropologists because we're concerned about, you know, how long you're going to last here with what you're doing to yourself and your planet and all that kind of stuff. Your listeners are well aware of.
Do they truly care about our existence?
Yes. Well, there are some that don't. I think you had a friend of mine on a while ago, Marshall Summers.
Yes.
He's part of this book. He's one of the more extended cases. And if you'll remember, your listeners will remember, he has been in contact in a channel. He does a lot of channeling of the angelic realm and the spiritual realm too. But some of the channeling you could call telepathic, I suppose, telepathic slash channeling, because the sources, the ET sources of some of this, are physically based. Maybe they can move in and out of physical. Maybe their home mode of embodiment is transphysical. But they were describing to him that they're actually on one of the asteroids, and they're trying to hide out from some of the other ETs. But what they're telling us is, watch out, planet Earth. Watch out, humankind. You are just like lambs being led to the slaughter. You're coming into the larger cosmic neighborhood, and you're like non-lucid, so to speak. You're naive as hell. You're not. You're very tribal and not very evolved yet compared to other extraterrestrials and other beings throughout the universe. You're on your way. You'll get there sooner or later. Where we now are, you one day will be. Where you now are, we once were. Kind of way of looking at it.
Are we easy marks?
Yes. We are easy marks for certain kinds of ETs. They are opportunistic. They're very much the capitalists. They're traders. They're, according to not only Marshall Summers channelings and telepathic transmissions, but also many others that side on this. It's a whole set of literature that I've studied that says, yes, there are opportunistic beings that really are self-serving. As you know, the Zeta Reticulans or the Greys in general, the hive mentality and the kind of dispassionate, not having a, they need to go to Oz and get a heart, so to speak, you know.
But
they do have a hive mentality, and they've overcome in their collective mode. Well, they a lot of them, it seems, which then is very prevalent, fills the abduction literature, as your listeners know. They're relatively self-serving. Some of them aren't. Some of them are. It's a spectrum. And so there you find some of that self-servingness or opportunistic quality. They're trying to save their own ass, so to speak, and preserving their own species with the decline of the DNA and all the ways to look at this, according to them, from the channel sources, according to them, and the abductee experiences. But, yes, what happens is... according to Summers and others, we have to be prepared, because it's naive to think that all extraterrestrials that we are going, when they land on the White House lawn or whatever's going to happen, you know, we kind of have like the American Indian meets the pilgrims or.
Well, it's what Hawking just said a few days ago.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's that precinct being heard from, and we'll hear more and more from it. Like, why do we think altruistically, Pollyannishly, that they're all going to be good and have our best interest at heart, and lo and behold, in the channel literature, there's a whole realm about those from Sirius and Orion and the reptilians. There are minorities out there, ET minorities. I mean, subsets of the whole ET kingdom that have a long history of kind of screw you, we're out for ourselves, and that's just survivalist, that's Darwinian, cosmic Darwinianism, and so,
we must be related to that
sect. Sure, well, that's why they're drawn to us. They're drawn to us because, you know, if we were like glowing in the dark, you know, light bodies and full of love and compassion, we wouldn't, like the Greys are drawn to us because there's a certain commonality there, and they have something to teach us, and we have something to teach them. We each have a piece of the puzzle for the other, and that comes out a lot in that literature, by the way, as you know. Well, so if this opportunistic quality is something to be forewarned and forearmed about, and that's what Summers and others like Paul Revere, you know, are running around saying. Be careful, be prepared. Now, you don't hear that from Stephen Greer particularly. He at least until recently, he was of the more traditional persuasion that it's all good.
Right, but you did hear it from David Jacobs and a few like that.
Sure, of course. Oh, sure. I mean, you could divide up, you know, like you can divide up the whole UFO literature into nuts and bolts types and then more kind of mystic spiritual or transdimensional larger reality types. You can also mix it up in terms of those that are kind of Pollyannish and it's all it's all good, and let's just go out there and sit on the with our flashlights.
Yeah, they love mankind.
Yeah, and that's not to say that there aren't a hunk of this. What we're talking about is cross-cultural studies, kind of multidimensional, multi-species, ethnographic, anthropological studies that we're now opening ourselves to more and more. Of that, we're not just looking at our planet Earth and Homo sapiens, but we're looking at, you know, a whole lot of other stuff, including extraterrestrials who have identified themselves through channels and other sources as being our the elders, the watchers, the seeders, the ancestors, the founders. You know, they really predate. That's the non-Darwinian way to look at our heritage, how we got seeded here. You know, they're our parents, they're our forebears, and a lot of you listeners know that story too. So, a lot of the ETs are. If you do this kind of cross-cultural studies, interplanetary studies, interspecies studies, a percentage of them, and I think I'd need to probably write something about this to kind of divvy it up with a lot more care taken than just off the cuff like this, but a percentage of them, I don't know exactly how big a percentage, are altruistic, are good, have our best interests at heart. The Pleiadians are usually perceived that way.
They've evolved the way you would expect them to, right?
Yes, yes, yes. And now a little side note on this. Some of you know Carla Ruckert McCarty, who was a channel for RAW, R-A, RAW, the Law of One.
Mm-hmm.
That's my most favorite channel material. It's lucid, crystal clear, very convincing. No way to prove it's RAW's not a human being, her own unconscious, her own fantasy proneness. Who knows? But I choose will to believe that Ra is who it claims to be, just like I believe Seth is that way and many others. Well, so here's Ra, and there's a kind of a Venusian or higher octave level side to it. It no longer is a physically embodied level of existence. And Ra starts off every communication through Carla saying, referring to what he's about to say as, this is a distortion of the Law of One. If you were truly speaking of the Law of One, it would be undistorted. It would be pure truth. It would be undifferentiated. It would be beyond words. It would be ineffable. It would be like looking at the face of God, or doing a mind meld to our Creator. That is the Law of One. And we're so far from that that everything that we experience, all our cognitions, all our science, all our belief systems are distortions of various ways and kinds and levels of the Law of One. So he's clear about that. And he's talking to us who are a lot more distorted than he was, like the unobstructed universe. He's a more unobstructed universe. We're in a more obstructed universe. And yet there's ways you take care in talking to someone who's stuck and non-lucidly within a more obstructed universe. So anyway, what Ra, I mentioned Ra because, through Carla Ruckert McCarthy, the channel stuff, is that Ra makes the distinction of service to self versus service to other. According to Ra, in the universe, across all kinds of beings, physically embodied and otherwise, all human and otherwise, and so on, that you start off service to self, and a self, you know, egotistical, self-centered, taking care of yourself, and you
evolve,
you evolve, and you reach a point that you shift over, you evolve further into the new domain of service to other. As long as you are still under service to self, as your polarity, you know, your kind of ray you're on, your way of being in the world, as long as you're at the service of self, you are going to be limited. Now, we're back to, like, who's in charge of all this? God, you know, the Galactic Federation. who knows? But there is a hierarchy. I believe there is a spiritual and a cosmological and a metaphysical hierarchy to this. I do believe, after all my decades of studying this, though I couldn't prove it to the skeptic. However, that in the service to self, you are limited. You are what do you call it? Embargoed. What's the term? You are quarantined. You're quarantined as a planet and a species. While you're service to what? Service to self, because you're dangerous. You could poke somebody's eye out with a stick, like the Three Stooges.
Sure. As we are right now.
Yeah. That's exactly where we are. So we're perceived that way by both service to self and service to other beings who are more evolved than us. And you can be more evolved than us and still be service to self. So there are extraterrestrials who've even moved beyond physical embodiment now, as a consensus reality, as their home habitation is no longer physical level reality.
Well, yet there are some people on this planet, John, who are giving, who are warm, who have put themselves on the back burner to help other people?
Of course, but both physically incarnate people like ourselves, incarnate human spirits, and discarnate human spirits, and extraterrestrials. Very much so. I haven't done the math to give you the best possible percentages or ratios I could give you, but I would say maybe a third of the ETs in the universe, physical and otherwise, are service to self, and two-thirds are service to other, maybe. But until you become service to other, the universe does not allow you to access new and more transcendent modes of technology and mind over matter capacity and reality creation.
Well, what do you mean they don't allow it? They'll hold us back, or
that's
what?
That's right, yeah. If you're service to self, you don't get to blow up your corner of the universe with hydrogen bombs, because it could tear, it could bleed through to other levels of reality. There could be consequences to our own, dumb kindergarten acts here, that those who don't want those consequences, either for themselves or for others who are looking in on this, are going to keep us from doing. Why should some scientist or inventor here get the light bulb go on in his or her head that here's an even bigger weapon, here's an even more powerful thing to make my totalitarian country, everybody bow down to them? I'm going to be a real big man on campus here. You're not allowed to get that or to bring it to fruition, because there is a control. There are cops. There's kind of benign cops on the beat for intergalactically for such planets and such evolving species.
What do you have to do to get in the club? How long does it take?
Have to go through the school of hard knocks, the soul growth, both individually and conjointly as a consensus reality, as a shared reality of pooled beings, whether they're physically embodied or move beyond it, to be able to have it dawn on you, get the point, the secret, that service to other is the way to go. Not just do it consciously to curry favor and to make a place for yourself in the afterlife or whatever, but just because it is the way God works. It is the way a spiritual universe may work. It's just better. If you really have your choice, and you're really lucid, and you're really awake and aware, and you have a meta level to look and reflect on all these things, you would choose that. It's what Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, said was the moral imperative. You sort of choose the moral and right thing once you're kind of cognizant of the choices, and you're guided that way. And so I believe that that's true, that once you open to service to other, individually and as a species, you are given new truths, new insights, new possibilities of playing in the fields of the Lord, so to speak, of being a co-creator with your creator, of being in the image of your maker and having your hands more untied, and to be able to be solar logos, to create new solar systems or planets, to be as unto a god. But boy,
and what you say, though, John, is the channeling that disembodied spirits do, it's pretty similar to what you're saying some of these ETs have the ability to do.
Yes, yes. And some of them have that ability, and they're still service to self in the raw sense. But most of them have reached the point that they have inherited or opened to or been bequeathed with this new science, spiritual technology, or this metaphysical technology and scientific understanding that allows them to do the kinds of things that parapsychology has long studied. Telepathy, mind over matter, levitation, materialization, dematerialization, being able to play with time as well as space.
Fascinating. John, stay with us. We're going to come back and take a final hour of phone calls with you. And Skype is open at George97313.